Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. This week, as we prepare to celebrate Thanksgiving, we take a moment to keep in our hearts and prayers all those who lost homes or loved ones in wildfires here in California, where more than 60 people have died and over 1,300 remain missing. Today we'll have stories for you on the rise in hate crimes nationally, and then hear about the latest court ruling on the San Onofre settlement case and a victory for attorney Micah Geary. We'll have updates on flips in two key election contests, California's state education superintendent, and Escondido's mayoral race. Then, hear why Petco is banning pet foods containing chemicals, and why county supervisors have banned target shooting near Dulzura. A former La Mesa lawyer has been sentenced to prison. Find out why on today's show. Santee will soon be getting a multiplex movie theater and restaurant. And out in Campo, the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum is celebrating its centennial. From Public News Service, we'll have stories on a racial divide in California's public college admissions and a report on successes in foster care programs in California. El Cajon is looking for Citizens of the Year nominations. And in Alpine, volunteers are needed to help beautify Alpine Boulevard. And finally, we'll replay one of our Best of East County episodes, our interview with Dana Law, who hiked the entire length of the Pacific Coast Trail from the Mexican border to Canada. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Hate crimes rose 17% last year over the year before, according to data released by the FBI under the Uniform Crime Reporting Program. This is the third year in a row that hate crimes have risen in the U.S. A total of 7,175 hate crimes were reported in 2017. Of those, more than 58% were motivated by bias based on race, ethnicity, or ancestry. Another 22% were crimes motivated by religious bias, and nearly 16% by sexual orientation. Of cases motivated by racial or ethnicity bias, nearly half targeted African Americans. Anti-white bias accounted for 17.5%, while nearly 11% targeted Hispanics, and 5.8% involved bias against Native Americans. Other hate crimes against multiracial, Asian, and Arab individuals measured in the low single digits. Among hate crimes motivated by religion, over 58% were anti-Jewish, and nearly 19% were anti-Islamic or Muslim. The number of anti-Semitic hate crimes targeting Jews rose 37% last year. Hate crimes targeting other religions were in the low single digits. Anti-Defamation League Director Jonathan Greenblatt says, "The report provides further evidence that more must be done to address the divisive climate of hate in America. That begins with leaders from all walks of life and from all sectors of society forcefully condemning anti-Semitism, bigotry, and hate whenever it occurs," he adds. Over 60% of all hate crimes targeted people, including intimidation or assault. Other crimes targeted property, including robbery, burglary, and arson. The most violent hate crimes included 15 murders and 23 rapes. Acting Attorney General Matthew G. Whitaker said the report is a call to action, adding, "The Department of Justice's top priority is to reduce violent crime in America, and hate crimes are violent crimes. They are also despicable violations of our core values as Americans." Whitaker said he was particularly troubled by the increase in anti-Semitic hate crimes, already the most common type of religious hate crimes in the U.S., the Washington Post reports. His statement came shortly after a deadly synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh. Some fault President Donald Trump for fanning the flames of hate with his divisive rhetoric, noting the rise in hate crimes corresponds to the president's tenure in office. The FBI data leaves out key incidents, so the total number of hate crimes may be far higher. For example, the FBI report left out the killing of Heather Heyer, a protester mowed down by a vehicle at a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. It also omitted the fatal stabbing of two men who tried to confront a man shouting racial slurs at a woman wearing a hijab on a train in Portland, Oregon. The Arab America Institute's executive director, Maya Berry, concludes that the FBI data, and what's missing from it, quote, demonstrates the hate crime reporting system we have in place is failing to respond adequately to hate crime, and thus inform fully the policy remedies we must make to improve our response to hate. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Getz.
The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has dismissed an appeal filed by the California Public Utilities Commission, which had sought to block payment of $5.4 million in legal fees to the law firm of former San Diego City Attorney Mike Aguirre. The fees were for work done by Aguirre's firm on behalf of ratepayers in a settlement that saved ratepayers $775 million related to shutdown costs of the San Onofre nuclear power plant. A radiation leak caused by a faulty steam generator led to the nuclear facility's 2012 shutdown. In 2014, the Public Utilities Commission approved making ratepayers foot the bill for 70% of the $4.7 billion in costs, with utility shareholders paying only 30%. Citizens Oversight, an El Cajon-based watchdog group led by Ray Lutz and other ratepayer advocates, filed suit in federal court, represented by Aguirre's firm. The case led to a revised settlement which made the company's shareholders pay an additional $775 million of those costs, reducing ratepayers' share to $3.3 billion. Even though Southern California Edison, the majority owner of the failed nuclear power plant along with SDG&E, agreed to pay the full $5.4 million in legal costs to Aguirre's firm without charging ratepayers, the Public Utilities Commission balked, claiming those fees were too high. But the federal court on Thursday rejected that argument. Ray Lutz, founder of Citizens Oversight, states, just as I predicted, judges threw out CPUC's attempt to block the result of the federal case settlement. Mike Aguirre and Mia Severinsen and their firm worked to undo the unfair settlement, and that required filing a case in federal court. He adds that without the case in which Citizens Oversight was the lead plaintiff, there is no way we would have gotten this improvement in the settlement, and the CPUC is unable to process this type of big hit to their friends running the utilities, Lutz said. And he concludes, I am happy to see it finally resolved. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jonathan Getz with an education report. A key statewide race has flipped with the counting of late mail-in and provisional ballots. Assemblyman Tony Thurmond, a social worker and educator, has pulled ahead in the state superintendent race. Thurmond now leads over Marshall Tuck by around 74,000 votes and a full percentage point. On election night, it was Tuck who led by a point. Over 3 million ballots remain to be counted, but thus far, late-mailed ballots and provisional ballots across California have favored Democrats and progressives, including helping Democrats pick up several congressional seats. While both Thurmond and Tuck are registered Democrats, Thurmond is endorsed by the Democratic Party, as well as the California Teachers Association. Last-minute mailers to voters affirmed the party's endorsement and criticized Tuck, former head of Charter Schools Association, who has also run school districts, for his financial support from the charter school industry. The final outcome may not be known for weeks, since California doesn't certify its results until December 7th, after all votes are counted.
Escondido's conservative and controversial mayor Sam Abed may soon be out of a job. He's trailing Democratic challenger Paul McNamara, known as Mac, by a full percentage point as the vote count nears completion, a flip from election night when Abed was leading. One reason may be the efforts of 50th Congressional District candidate Amar Campanajar, the Democratic challenger to indicted Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter. Although Hunter has held on to his lead by about 5%, Campanajar's campaign outreach and spending exceeded any past effort on behalf of a Democratic candidate in the district in recent memory, maybe ever. While ballots are still being counted, so far Campanajar has more than doubled the number of votes cast for Hunter's last midterm challenger, James Kimber. Campanajar's efforts generated massive turnout that likely lifted down-ballot Democrats to victory. the $3.2 million Camp Najar campaign, phone banked, canvassed, and advertised to thousands of voters in Escondido alone, where not only does McNamara appear to be likely the city's new Democratic mayor, but the city also elected Democratic City Council candidates Consuelo Martinez in District 1 and Vanessa Valenzuela in District 2, whose campaigns also helped to mobilize progressive voters. Newly active members of Escondido Indivisible and other progressive groups volunteered with the Camp Najar campaign and the Democratic Party, and the Escondido Democratic Club's GO team took action on behalf of Camp Najar and all Democratic candidates. The race also saw unprecedented investment by progressive PACs in partnership with local activists, targeting Escondido voters to turn out the votes for Camp Najar. The San Diego Independent Expenditure Group, Independent Indivisible, known as Indy Squared, partnered with progressive PACs Indivisible Action, Flip the 14, and Code Blue to increase voter turnout. They sent out over 15,000 texts, over 12,000 phone calls, and knocked on 1,900 doors just in Escondido, targeting new voters, Democrats, independent voters, people who skipped midterm elections in the past, and Latino voters, including robocalls from civil rights leader Dolores Huerta. Mayor Abed's controversial policies likely also generated a stronger-than-expected vote for his opponent. The mayor's privatization of the public library, his long-standing anti-immigrant rhetoric and actions turning around a busload of immigrant children, and Abed's May meeting with Presidential Trump to criticize California offended many constituencies and inspired protests outside City Hall in the closing weeks of the campaign. Maureen Gupta, with Independent Indivisible, says many factors impact an upset like the one we may be seeing in the Escondido mayor's race. But, she adds, the value of Democratic coattails in a deeply red district is an important lesson that will motivate activists to lift even more down-ballot candidates in the next election. If we replicate the Amar effect in 2020, she concludes, the McNamara-Abed race should put complacent Republicans across San Diego County on notice that their seats can no longer be taken for granted. Reporting for East County Magazine, on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is John Fistier with a business report. Petco, a San Diego-based retailer, has announced that it will no longer be selling pet foods or treats containing artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives for dogs and cats after May 2019. The move makes Petco the first and only major retailer of pet foods and treats to ban chemical ingredients. Petco CEO Ron Coughlin says some may question whether this makes good business sense, but putting pets' health first has always been the right thing to do for Petco. He calls the action a major step forward for pets and a natural next step on our journey to become a complete partner in total pet wellness. And, he adds, we hope the rest of the pet industry will join us on this path to better health for the pets we love. This isn't the first time Petco has taken an industry-leading stance. In 2014, it became the first national specialty retailer to stop the sale of treats made in China after consumer concerns about safety, and other retailers quickly followed suit. With these new standards, the company aims to raise the bar again for the entire pet retail industry. The change reflects one of the top concerns pet parents have today, nutrition. It's no coincidence that pet food trends follow closely behind human food trends. According to a recent survey by Edelman Intelligence, 87% of pet owners say that feeding their pet food with no artificial flavors, artificial colors, or artificial preservatives is important to pets' health and well-being, with 59% of vets agreeing. Moreover, 95% of pet owners believe their pet's diet and nutrition is essential to overall health and wellness, yet more than half say finding healthy products for their pets is confusing, and another 47% reporting that finding healthy pet products is difficult. Dr. Susan Wynn, a veterinary nutritionist at Blue Pearl Veterinary Partners in Atlanta, says consumer opinions have more influence on company practices now than ever before. Nearly 70% of millennials are up to buy foods with natural ingredients, she says. Next year, Petco will also launch the Petco Pet Wellness Institute, with veterinarians, nutritionists, pet psychologists, academic researchers, and other experts to advise the company on offering information, education, and services related to pets' health and well-being. The Institute's mandate will include funding evidence-based research on topics including the impact of food and ingredients on pet health.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
For years, DelZora residents have complained of repeated brush fires sparked by target shooters on Federal Bureau of Land Management property. At least one homeowner reported bullets hitting his house. Some homes were in the area before the BLM acquired the land. Now, San Diego County supervisors have voted to ban target shooting on two BLM sites south of State Route 94 and Campo Road, west of Marin Valley Road, under a federal agreement. The ban does not apply to game hunting, which remains legal in season. The action was proposed by Supervisor Diane Jacob and passed 3-1, with Supervisor Bill Horn opposed and Kristen Gaspar absent. Supervisor Jacob said in addition to residents voicing concerns, the Border Patrol had also advised her that they fear for their agent's safety in the area due to the shooting. The ban was opposed by gun rights supporters who wanted more enforcement instead of outlawing target shooting. The shooting advocates said most other outdoor shooting ranges have already been shut down, some converted to wildlife preserves, others closed by the state due to fire dangers. Times of San Diego reports that Michael Schwartz, executive director of San Diego County Gun Owners, said he was told by a U.S. Interior Department official that no county officials contacted him about the problem. However, Supervisor Jacob provided the media with a letter back in May 2017 that she sent to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke on the issue. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Fistier with a Crime Beat report. A former La Mesa attorney, Clayton Anderson, has been sentenced to serve 18 months in federal prison for defrauding clients and investors. Anderson, who was disbarred in 2015, was also ordered to pay over $1.5 million in restitution to his victims. He pled guilty back in July to wire fraud and money laundering in connection with a fraudulent investment scheme. U.S. Attorney Adam Braverman told the court that Anderson portrayed the trust that clients played in him as their attorney, adding, "This prison sentence serves as a warning and demonstration to the commitment of the United States Attorney's Office to protecting the rights of investors, especially those investing with their own attorney, to candid, truthful information." As a part of his guilty plea, Anderson admitted that his investment pitch to his clients violated his duties as an attorney and that he made multiple false claims. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Anderson was in dire financial straits at the time, concealing his law firm's bankruptcy from his clients. He withdrew settlement money from a client trust account without permission, transferring some funds into a retirement account that he controlled. Damon Rowe, special agent with the IRS Criminal Division, says, "The blatant fraud and deceit carried out by this former attorney is unconscionable," adding, "The honesty and integrity Americans expect from their attorney must never be compromised, which is why we will continue to work with all levels of law enforcement to root out unscrupulous attorneys and hold them accountable."
Santee will finally get an indoor movie theater and another restaurant or two to go with it. The long-awaited project that was a top priority of elected officials and most of the city's candidates is slated to become a reality after unanimous approval by Santee's City Council on November 14th. The council voted to enter into a development agreement with Interact LLC to build a multi-screen movie theater and restaurant operated by Studio Movie Grill, a Dallas-based company that pioneered the dine-in cinema concept starting in the 1990s. The $17 million project will be located just north of the Trolleytown Square near Cuyamaca Street. Joe Harburg, partner in the development firm working exclusively for Studio Movie Grill, says the land's previous owner, San Diego County, tried several times to create a theater complex at the site but failed because of the money needed for grading, utility installation, and permits before construction could begin. So several years ago, the county sold the parcel to Santee for just $1. Last October, Santee entered into an agreement with another developer, Kimco Realty Corporation, and operator Cinemark, to build a similar combined theater and restaurant complex, but that deal fell through. That prompted the city to reach out to the runners-up starting in February. The new agreement calls for the creation of at least 9 theaters and possibly as many as 12, along with an upscale restaurant to serve both moviegoers and the public, including an outdoor patio bar open year-round. The plan also provides for a second restaurant that would be operated by another company. Theater seats will be luxury recliners complete with trays to hold your food and drinks and buttons to press if you want to place an order. Construction is expected to begin soon after escrow closes and be completed within 18 months. Santee has not had an indoor movie house since 2000, when AMC closed its location there. The city currently has only a drive-in theater, one of the last remaining in the state. A new movie theater has been named a high priority by many Santee residents. The new multiplex theater will also bring jobs. A similar complex recently acquired by Studio Movie Grill in Northern California led to ads seeking to hire 200 employees. The company operates 30 locations in 9 states, according to its website, and recently licensed deals for locations in Saudi Arabia and South Africa. This year, Studio Movie Grill made the Inc. magazine top 5,000 fastest-growing private companies list. Santee Mayor John Minto is eager to see the curtains rise at the new theater complex, stating, "I personally can't wait for this to happen." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show, and now it's time for the Sounds of History.
This is John Fister with East County Magazine's Sounds of History. The Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association is launching a year-long 100-year anniversary celebration to commemorate completion of the San Diego and Arizona Railway back on November 15, 1919. A reenactment ceremony at the Campo Railroad Park and Museum will be held next year on November 16, 2019. Between now and then, centennial activities will include free lectures at libraries and community groups, special events with other local historical organizations, a groundbreaking festival and presentation of silent movies with chase scenes showing the San Diego and Arizona Railway. Free lectures by volunteers and the loan of a traveling exhibit can be requested at psrm.org. Diana Hyatt, president of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, says, "We're very excited about kicking off our year-long celebration and the leading up to the 100th anniversary of the country's final transcontinental railroad," adding, "We invite all San Diego residents to join the celebration." Predominantly financed by entrepreneur John D. Spreckles, at a cost of $18 million, or roughly $123,000 per mile, the rail line was called the Impossible Railroad by engineers of its day due to the immense logistical challenges. Those challenges included extreme terrain requiring 2.5 miles of bridges and trestles and 21 tunnels, with 11 miles through the treacherous Carrizo Gorge, an area where cliffs dropped more than 1,000 feet to the bottom. Additional construction challenges included floods, landslides, fires, hot weather, deaths from the flu, sabotage by Mexican revolutionaries, and various delays caused by World War I. Stretching 148 miles from San Diego to El Centro, the San Diego and Arizona Railway included 44 miles in Mexico and took 12 years to complete. On November 15, 1919, Spreckels himself drove the final golden spike, which he accidentally bent during a ceremony held at Carrizo Gorge, 35 miles east of Campo, in Anzo Borrego Desert State Park, attended by an estimated crowd of 1,000 people, including dignitaries, city officials, and residents. Photos show the crowd laughing at the bent iron railway spike, which was plated with gold. Completion of the San Diego and Arizona Railway established a direct continental rail link to the east, connecting with the Southern Pacific Railroad in El Centro. Before then, San Diegans had to travel to Los Angeles to connect with an eastbound train. The line is still partially in use today for vintage train rides at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Depot, where you can also view vintage trains and memorabilia. A portion of the line is also still used by three freight operators. There are also aspirations by some investors to restore the line and to someday reopen the impossible railway line across East County's rugged terrain.
California's most selective public colleges still admit far too few Black and Latino students, according to a new report out today. Researchers at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce found that 6 out of 100 college-age students in California are Black, but only 3 of 100 students are Black at schools such as Cal Poly, San Diego State, and a bunch of UCs, including UCLA, UC Berkeley, Davis, Irvine, San Diego, Santa Barbara, and Santa Cruz. Those numbers did not improve at all from 2005 to 2015. Martin Vanderwerf, a study co-author, blames part of this on inequality in funding for K-12 schools.
It becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy over time. We give more resources to the wealthier districts produce students who do better on the tests, those students go on to the selective colleges, and things just don't tend to change over time.
However, Latino representation has improved, going from 14% of freshmen at selective public colleges in 2005 up to 25% 10 years later. The report also found that 85% of students at selective institutions graduate, and it found that those schools spend 5 times as much money on instruction and academic support compared with open admission public colleges, the biggest gap in any state. Vanderwerf says the schools should take more than just the SATs into account when making admissions decisions, adding that test scores inherently favor whites.
Whites do better on standardized tests. Latinos do second best, and Blacks, of the three groups, they do the worst. And so when you rely on testing as an entry measure, whites are always going to do better.
The study also found that state funding is very unequal. California's selective public colleges received $8,800 per student in 2015, whereas open access public colleges received $2,400 less. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Each year, El Cajon's civic service and fraternal organizations select the El Cajon Citizen of the Year from the many people in El Cajon who contribute to the city through years of volunteer civic and community service. Active community groups or individuals can nominate a candidate for the Citizen of the Year by sending a representative of your organization to the selection committee meetings. Your nomination must be submitted on a special form, which must be submitted by December 14th at 4 p.m. The 2018 El Cajon Citizen of the Year and all nominees will be honored at the noon luncheon on February 5th. At the Elks Lodge. If you have questions, you can contact the San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce at 619-440-6161. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Miriam Raftery with a People Power report. 2 years after construction of Sunrise Powerlink left Alpine Boulevard bare through the heart of rural Alpine, a beautification project is taking root. The Alpine Mountain Empire Chamber of Commerce, Backcountry Land Trust, and the Certified Community Wildlife Habitat are organizing efforts to plant trees and other greenery. Ace Hardware has donated topsoil to help drought-tolerant native plants grow. Backcountry Land Trust is donating 500 plants through a grant, and the Chamber is helping with permits for plots on county right-of-way areas. Certified Community Wildlife Habitat is signing up volunteers to water the plants. On Saturday, December 1st, it will be Volunteer Day for the Community Project. If you would like to volunteer to help beautify the boulevard, be a sponsor, or volunteer to water the plants, you can call the Alpine Mountain Empire Chamber of Commerce at 619-445-2722.
California's teenage foster youth are doing better than the national average in several important ways, according to a new report. The Annie E. Casey Foundation research says 84% of kids who leave the foster care system at age 21 have their high school diploma, a rate 8% higher than the national average. California foster kids also have a better record for finding jobs and avoiding homelessness. Amber Twitchell with the Voices Youth Center credits a policy change in recent years since the state stopped relying on group homes.
So really moving away from the traditional kind of old school models where we would just put kids in houses together and have somebody check on them to really focusing on getting kids into families whenever we can. That's really what the continuum of care is all about.
The numbers are not all rosy, however. The report found that 49% of California's foster children have had placements in three or more homes, which is close to the national average of 51%. Overall, about 70,000 kids in the Golden State are in foster care. Leslie Gross with the Jim Casey Youth Opportunities Initiative says there's a huge need out there for foster families willing to make a permanent connection with a teenager.
Young people really need supportive adults to rely on to make difficult decisions that happen in just everyday life and help them get on a path to financial and emotional stability.
The report says California could do more to help older foster children transition to adulthood, as only 1% get room and board assistance, only 11% get financial assistance for education, and 20% participate in job training programs. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Dana Law. Dana is a magician, but he's recently completed his greatest feat, which involved no magic at all, just a lot of walking. He hiked the entire Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada, all 2,650 miles of it, and they say that's the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest 16 and a half times. Dana, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I understand you hiked the trail in several sections over a number of years. How long did it take you to complete it?
I started hiking the Pacific Crest Trail right here in San Diego at Campo. That's the beginning of the trail. We call it the Southern Terminus. In May of 2003, 13 years later, 31 separate sections later, going north without missing a step, I crossed the Canadian border in August of 2016 and went into Canada.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That is quite a feat. What made you determined to hike the entire length of the Pacific Crest Trail?
I was an early reader, loved reading. I should have done my homework or read the books that the teachers had told me to read. But what I decided to do was read books about adventure and challenges and visiting all the unusual places in the world. And much later in my life, I've always exercised. I've always been into fitness and health. But I decided that I needed to do something that was an adventure, have my own adventure. And we started walking. And the first thing I did is I hiked all the way across San Diego County, going from the west to the east. I started at Torrey Pines Beach and walked all the way to the Salton Sea.
Wow, that is a lot of walking.
That's the Sea to Sea Trail, and it's still available. It's 140 miles. And then along that time, during that time, I met somebody that had hiking experience, and I'd already read about the Pacific Crest Trail that goes all the way to Canada, starting right here in San Diego County, which mm-hmm. is pretty darn cool, don't you think?
I agree.
He was an experienced hiker, experienced backpacker, which is necessary for hiking the trail. And I told him about my dream of doing it, and we decided to start doing it in sections, as I mentioned, in May of 2003, to have this great adventure. And that's when it all began. And I'll tell you later, and just briefly now, that Bill Redman, my hiking partner at the time, who hiked about half of the sections with me, or I should say with him, we both crossed the border into Canada together as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. I was going to ask if you hiked any parts of it alone or if you brought friends along with you all the time.
I always had hiking partners, except when I got into northern Oregon. The hiking partner that I had was not well. Sadly, it turned out later that he passed away of his illness.
That's sad.
But I had to, for the first time, walk 288 miles from northern Oregon into Washington State. 288 miles in 15 days by myself. It was a wonderful adventure, but I must say that for me, hiking is for the society. To be alone is not my goal.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the scenery that you saw along the way, starting with what the scenery looks like right here in San Diego County along the Pacific Crest Trail.
Well, you know, they call it the Pacific Crest Trail, but it doesn't always go along the crest of the mountains. There are places ahead that you go through many mountains. But right here in San Diego County, it's surprisingly beautiful. As you go up the trail and you cross Highway 8 here in San Diego, that's about 30 miles into the hiking of the trail, you get into the lagunas, which fortunately in many parts, most parts, survived the disastrous fires of 2003 and 5. And so you get, not only do you get into the forest there, but you have wonderful views of the Anzabrego Desert to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you go farther along, even the meadows south of Warner Springs are quite beautiful.
They are. I've seen portions of it up there. How long is the stretch of the Pacific Crest Trail that runs through San Diego County? Do you know?
I'm going to guess it's about 100-plus trail miles.
Mm-hmm. And then once you head out of San Diego County, what are some of the other highlights along the way?
You enter Riverside County, and it's pretty bleak until you get to the San Jacintos. That's the mountains, as you probably know, that are between Hemet and Idyllwild, up on the mountain, and Palm Springs, the Coachella Valley. And you start climbing into the mountains. You get into beautiful forests. Once again, you have great views of the Coachella Valley. And you climb over Mount San Jacinto and then descend into the desert. And you go up again into the San Bernardinos.
There you go. And then on up into the Sierras and Oregon and Washington. What were a couple of the favorite things that you saw along the way? Where were your favorite stretches of it?
Once you get over the San Jacintos, you get into the San Bernardinos, but you're basically going west, and you continue on through the Angeles Crest. That's the mountain range north of Los Angeles. And then you, once again, you get fabulous views to the north of the Mojave Desert. Beautiful views of Big Bear Lake up there. Plus, you continue on into the Angeles Crest, the mountains that are north of Los Angeles. And great views not only to the south of the cities, but more importantly, the beautiful views of the Mojave Desert to the north. And then you continue on through some areas that are not so beautiful necessarily, but you continue north of the Mojave, and eventually you start your trip into the Sierras.
Did you hike in all four seasons?
Well, I'm a self-employed businessman. So what I was doing early on, particularly, and then it became longer in the future, is doing these sections where several, usually a day or 2 days or 3 days, got a little longer as I got farther north. It was harder to plan a trip that didn't take a few days because we had to create some mileage. But the answer to your question is in all seasons. And one of my minor mistakes in the beginning, as we're coming down to the Angeles Crest, is hiking, or I should say the San Bernardinos, is it was April, but we still had 100 degree temperatures there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. On those days, water is everything. Water is always everything on the Pacific Crest Trail. And several days we didn't suffer from serious dehydration, but it was a big concern.
That's a really big risk. I thought you were going to tell me that you got caught up there maybe in the off season with an unexpected snowstorm somewhere, which is another, I guess, possible risk, right?
And interestingly enough, until we got to the San Bernardinos and the San Gorgonio Mountain, we never saw any snow more than about 50 feet long. And I never saw any significant snow until I finally got into Washington State.
Interesting. What are some of the most dramatic or exciting things that did happen to you along the Pacific Crest Trail in all these years?
First of all, you see things that almost no one will ever see unless they go out into the wilderness. You're going to see incredible vistas. When you're in the Sierras, you realize the effect of glaciers, these incredible mountains that have been carved away over millennia. I say millennia, it's longer than that, that are quite beautiful with views, etc. You know, you go through volcanic areas in Oregon. You're just behind dormant volcanoes. There's a volcano, Mount Lassen, in Northern California, which has only been dormant for 100 years, 110 years or something like that.
Well, of course, Washington, they have Mount St. Helens. It's still active, so to speak. Is that
you get a good view of Mount St. Helens. Rainier is an absolutely gorgeous view up there.
Gorgeous. I hiked Rainier a number of years ago, not quite all the way to the top, but high enough to get to iced crevices and things. And it was quite spectacular because it was right after the Mount St. Helens erupted. And so you had this kind of otherworldly view of ashes that had fallen on the snow and on the ice crevices.
Right.
Were you ever interrupted along the way by anything?
It happened only once, and that was supposed to be our finishing year, 2015. We were in Washington State, and it was a year of terrible fires up there. At first, we thought, oh, we had a couple hundred mile section to get to the Canadian border, and we thought, oh, we should be able to avoid it. And then we found out there was some part of the trail was closed, and we saw there was an alternative trail to go around. And the next thing we know, all the trails were keeping us off finishing the trail, and we weren't able to do that till 2016.
Did you have any injuries or illnesses that befell you or your hiking partners along the way?
You know, I've fallen many times. Anybody says they've hiked and not tripped is not telling the truth.
Yeah.
A couple of times I was hiking along with my big floppy hat on my head, and there was a tree across the trail, and I thought I was walking under it, and I ran right into it.
Oops.
But the answer to your question is the only terrible things, and a couple of them were quite difficult, have happened to my hiking partners. One of my hiking partners, John Hart, in Northern California, tripped and punctured his eye.
Ooh.
And he had to be helicoptered out. I was fortunate enough to get a cell signal and be able to call in the what turned out to be a CHP helicopter. He had to have a corneal implant.
Oh, my.
And on the very first day of our hike in May of 2003, a hiking partner of Bill, a friend of Bill, had heat prostration. He also had to be helicoptered off.
Wow. So you just have to be really prepared. But I guess beyond being prepared, bringing your communications along with you, making sure that cell phone is charged and so forth, which brings me to another question. You started this way back in 2003 when we were all still using, you know, dial-up corded phones and so forth, right? Before the advent of everyone having a computer they could carry around on their phone. How has the technology changed the way that you navigate and communicate? And are there any other, you know, special gizmos that you bring along with you on these long trips?
Very good question. Of course, we did start in the dark ages of flip phones. That very first day when I had to call in the authorities to pick up my hiking partner's friend, I had a flip phone. I had to climb up to a high point and call them in on 911.
Yeah.
fighting with a signal from Mexico saying, did I want to use their system?
And that nice Mexican long-distance phone bill.
Yeah, that's right. That was a big worry. But it's been transformed. I now carry a smartphone, and the smartphone has become our GPS.
Yeah.
We navigate with our smartphones on apps that are specifically for the Pacific Crest Trail.
That's great. And are you able to get a signal along all or most of the trail now?
It's not uncommon to be able to get a cell signal just about anywhere. It turns out that Verizon has the best service for that.
I would second that. This isn't an ad for anybody, but I know across the backcountry I have that, and I've often been able to get Verizon when nobody else could. And we had kind of an interesting story, a life-saving story a few years ago, where there was a couple of rock climbers, and they were trapped on the face of El Capitan, or El Cajon Mountain, we call it out here, during when a wildfire started. It had burned their rope, and they called for help, and they were able to get cell phone service on the middle of this rock face in the El Monte Valley, where even the fire captain down below, who had been calling for an update, couldn't call me back because his cell phone didn't have service there.
Wow.
Different company. And they got it up there, and they were able to get a helicopter into him just in time to do this really dramatic, you know, tow-in rescue. And one guy, the sheriff deputy, had to ride down hanging onto the outside of the helicopter through the flames. They won the governor's award for valor. But I'm saying this as an example of why you want to do your research and make sure that whatever cell phone you take along, that you've researched where it actually gets service and where it doesn't. Be sure you get one that will work.
Over the years, people have provided reports about what their cell phone connectivity was in different places.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, that cell phone is now the GPS. Even though we're on, if we're in the wilderness, we're on airplane mode to protect the battery to make it last longer. And we do
Good
have
tip.
backup batteries
Good
to keep
tip.
It going.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a see where you're at in the world. It tells you exactly where you're at and information about the trail, how far ahead the road crossing is, the next water, the next camping spot.
That's great.
Remarkable.
Well, and if they have lights on them, like so many cell phones do, I suppose if you're stranded and it's night and you're waiting for the helicopter to find you, you can shine the light up and help them locate where you are.
That might be true. I haven't used that yet, but to your point.
There's no lasers, but only at the basic
light. That's right. Have to get that app.
Because I've arrested them for that.
Well, the thing that reminds me of is that for the last 4 or 5 years, I've carried a satellite communicator. So you're able to Bluetooth connect wirelessly with that communicator. And I, regardless of whether I have a cell signal or not, I can send out a message that I'm fine or I need help. I can even make a basic Facebook post now with a satellite communication device.
That's amazing. What other advice would you give to hikers who might be considering taking on the Pacific Crest Trail?
Well, number one, start hiking. Don't take on a big hike, first off. Just go out and take a hike. What you're going to find out as you do the thing is that you're going to learn as you go along. Now, to be prepared, obviously, you need to have everything you need to do to survive in the wilderness. I wouldn't recommend you go into the wilderness on your first hikes.
Right.
But it's something that you never stop learning. You want to know what kind of food you're going to take. You want to make sure there's plenty of water, water sources, how much you're going to need.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want some fitness to be able to do this.
Sturdy hiking boots.
We don't use hiking boots anymore. Because that is advanced technologically so much, our equipment is much lighter. I have been walking, the entire trail in trail running shoes.
No kidding.
Yeah. But you still are you have your house on your back, mm-hmm. and you have to decide what goes in there. So you have to have a tent. You have to have your sleeping bag. You have to have the food that you need, the snacks as you go along on the trail.
Now, do you need permits for any of these areas? Like, for example, I know that in Cleveland National Forest here in East County, you need permits if you're going to go hike to places like Cedar Creek Falls, for instance, or Three Sisters Falls. I don't know if those are part of this trail or not, but.
Absolutely. You're going through several places that are state and federal parks, national parks, where you'll need permission. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful organization. This may be the most important thing that people learn from this talk today. An organization called the Pacific Crest Trail Association, PCTA.org, PCTA.org. All the information about permits and what you need to do is there. And as a matter of fact, they have a wonderful agreement with the Forest Service where they provide the permission and the information that you need to pass through these different areas.
Well, that's very good advice. It must have just been an amazing feeling to finally cross over the Canadian border all these years after you started this way back in 2003 and complete the last stretch of the Pacific Crest Trail, which listeners, if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dana Law, who recently completed the 2,650-mile-long Pacific Crest Trail from just north of the Mexican border to Canada, which he did in a number of segments over quite a few years. So how did it feel to finally finish, and what did you do to celebrate?
It was wonderful. It's interesting. You get there, and you think, oh, this will be a border crossing, but it's still in the wilderness. It's another 11 miles to walk a trail into a road in Canada.
Wow.
There's no border patrol. There's no gate. There's no official. We are carrying something you can get on the Pacific Crest Trail site from Canada that gives you permission, that warns them that you're coming, you'll be crossing the border. But to answer your question, it was probably one of the most exciting days in my life.
That's fabulous. Also curious what kind of wildlife you saw along the way.
Remarkably little. Oh, you know, you hear noises and stuff like that. But
no mountain lions, black bears or anything.
I have probably been seen by a lot of mountain lions and bears. You see a lot of deer. But in the entire 2,650 miles, I've seen one bear. However, you will see their footprints on the trail. They like the trail better than they do bushwhacking through the wilderness and the bushes and the trees.
Can't blame them.
Yeah. A lot of snakes, especially at low elevations.
Hawks, eagles?
Hawks and eagles, you know, I don't know much about flora and fauna. I've learned a little bit as I went along. People usually had to explain what I was seeing.
There you go.
I've seen some grouse. That's a bird.
There you go.
Nope. And mice, they love chewing away at your food bag. If you put it in the wrong place, they'll make a hole in it so they can get some snacks.
I can remember finding a chipmunk in my backpack once. He was just munching away on that trail mix very happily.
Of course.
What's up next for you now that you've completed the Pacific Crest Trail? What else are you planning?
Right now, I'm doing the Arizona Trail. I've been the last year and a half, I've done three separate sections, 263 miles of the 800-mile Arizona Trail. It goes from the Mexican border in Arizona, south of Tucson, all the way to Utah. And it's the last 50 miles, 50 miles before it ends, I should say, there is you cross the Grand Canyon. Go down and go up out of the Grand Canyon.
Spectacular area.
Yeah. And so I'll be back there in November and the following March of 2019 to continue on. I picked up a new hiking partner, and he's as smart as can be, young guy. Always hang around young people, Miriam.
That's very the answer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stay mm-hmm. young yourself.
Yeah, don't hang around old people. I mean, in attitude.
You remind me of my grandmother, who lived to be into her 90s, and she was always outliving her friends, and she liked to play cards. And so she just kept getting younger and younger card-playing buddies that were about half or a third her age.
That's right.
There you go. You're young at heart. I understand that you've got some appearances coming up locally where you're going to be speaking more about your trips along the Pacific Crest Trail. Where can people go in San Diego or East County to hear those?
The next Adventures on the Pacific Crest Trail talk is this coming Saturday, the 16th, El Cajon Library at 2 p.m. That's June 16th, this coming Saturday, at the El Cajon Library at 2 p.m. I'm also going to be in August at the University Community Library. That's in basically UTC. It's on Governor. That's August 22nd at 6 p.m. At the University Community Library on Governor Drive in University City.
Very good. And if people want to read more about your adventures, where can they find that?
Facebook. Adventures on the PCT.
Pacific Coast Trail. So Adventures on the PCT on Facebook.
Right. And You'll find my blog there. I was able to, and I really respect what you do for a living, writing things down is one of the hardest things I've done is write coherently. Thank goodness I have my wife for an editor. For every journey, all 31 separate sections, there's a complete journal of my trip from back in May of 2003 to June of 2016, and with pictures and video. And there's a great video I was able to take at the northern terminus of the Canadian border that I think people will enjoy and sums up my feelings about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. Once again, the Facebook page is Adventures on the PCT, Pacific Crest Trail, Adventures on the PCT. I'm Dana Law, D-A-N-A-L-A-W. You can find me there by Googling. There's a complete journal of all my trips, 31 separate sections starting in May of 2003 through the end at the northern terminus of the Canadian border. I was able to put down all the information, and there's some pictures there. There's also a great video of me and my hiking partner, Bill. Bill and I started the trail together, ended the trail together, and it was a wonderful experience, a wonderful day. And you'll see that video there. I think it's quite moving, how we felt about completing this wonderful adventure.
That's fantastic. That's a great resource for anyone else who may be thinking of hiking either the full trail or any of these sections to go on and get that information. Tell me why the Pacific Crest Trail itself is important to you, Dana.
Gee, you know what? You start out with a personal feeling of a challenge. A lot of people talk about going into the wilderness and being at one with nature. Frankly, that's never been my thing. It's not that I don't appreciate nature, but I will say about a half an hour after enjoying nature on a daily hike as you're going up the trail, you go, I'm good with nature. And for me, it's the community with another hiker. It's a challenge. It's probably the most physical and the biggest physical and mental challenge of my life. You realize that you have everything within inside of you to pull this off, to do something that's very difficult mentally and physically.
Yeah, it's quite an accomplishment. And I know that with all of the threats to our public lands that we're seeing now across the United States, you've also told me that the trail symbolizes to you everything that there is to love and protect in the Western United States.
It does. I mean, obviously that's true for across the United States, the contiguous United States and Alaska and Hawaii, etc. One of the things that's great about the Pacific Crest Trail Association is they're doing everything possible to protect the trail and expand the trail and keep it from being encroached upon. If you're interested in that, as I am, and obviously you are, you'll find that they're doing a great job, even in these challenging times for ecology.
Yes, and that's the Pacific Crest Trail Association. And your blog, again, can be found, listeners, at the PCT page on Facebook. And if people want to get in touch with you, Dana, if they have more questions or maybe they want to email you or call you, what's the best way for people to get in touch?
It should be Facebook. Once again, Adventures on the PCT. Just Google that or just put it into the search function in Facebook and you'll find me there. And obviously you can communicate, you can chat with me, send me an email. I'd love to talk to you.
Very good. Well, I'm envious. It just sounds like the adventure of a lifetime. And we want to thank you so much, Dana, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
A joy to be with you.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County into Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.